and welcome back to the Clear Voice podcast. This week, I spoke to journalist and author Daisy Buchanan. We spoke about how books can change your life, knowing your worth, and the art of saying no. Here we go. So Daisy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. I am a big fan of your books and your podcast.
Thank you.
Yes, I generally love books. I have a bit of a problem when I go to a library. I generally come out like with my credit card, my library card maxed. Also my credit card if I didn't go to the library. Tell me a little bit about how you fell in love with books and how they changed your life.
I was really lucky because my parents are both big readers and they always had a lot of books around. And I think that for my dad, especially because his mum, my nan, she was a bit like, she wouldn't sort of give a book as a gift because she's like, well, you've read it and then what are you going to do with it? So he really had to fight to have books. And I know that his sister, my auntie Maria, and his brothers were all kind of keen readers. And I think that they really benefited in some ways from the fact that reading was something they sort of had to work to do. Also, you know, as a child, I don't think people bought books quite as casually as they do now. So both my parents wanted us to just have books that we could kind of, you know, dip into. And I think as well, being the eldest of six girls, you know, reading was a bit of privacy when everyone's sort of on top of you all the time, figuratively and literally. You can go and do something that's quite intimate and individual and far away from everyone. There were, you know, stories that we had read to us that we loved. But then I remember that, reading Little Women, and I loved it. I really loved it. I was like, yes, I'm Meg. I might revisit that now. But my sister Beth, Jo, damn, she's very like Jo as well. I don't know if she felt a bit too soon, but she hated it so much that I had to sort of continue reading Little Women on my own because she
really?
Was just... I don't know whether it was that, this idea that, you know, it was something that she was told that she was supposed to love. But then, you know, things like Swallows and Amazons, my sister adored. Once I got beyond the fact that it's hilarious, there's a character called Fanny. I was like, I don't think this is for me. there's a line. Oh, no, that is it. I'm sure there is a line in Swallows and Amazons. I think this isn't even a real name. This is insanity. I think there might be a character called Titty. And there's a bit in the book where it says something like, everyone wanted hats like dicks and mittens like titties.
Oh, my God. I feel like I need to put Swallows and Amazons on my reading list.
So yeah, that's the best bit, I think.
Is that it? That's the highlight.
But definitely, you know, you've talked about being the eldest of three girls. So I don't know if you can relate to this.
Oh, well, I think two girls, one boy. But we can call Rolia girls. Fine, you know. Yeah, I think he's sort of been an honorary girl most of his life.
Brought into the clan.
Exactly.
Finding really, really exciting books and, you know, being desperate to like to get to the grown-up stuff with mixed results. You know, some was really great. I read Dorothy Parker as a sort of very pubescent, like pre-teenager. And actually it was my dad who was like, you look like you're having difficult times. I think you'd enjoy this. And he was right. It was great. But then I read things like American Psycho far too early. And it did, I have been revisiting Bret Easton Ellis ever since, and I've had a fluctuating relationship with him. But then I think I started reading the Tales of the City books when I was 13 or 14, and they just dazzled me. And I lived in this very sort of conservative, with a large and a small C, a tiny, tiny town in Dorset, you know, and I didn't really... You know, it was very white, it was very sort of old-fashioned, and, you know, people said that, because actually, I think Enid Blyton was familiar with the area, and obviously, it's close to Brownsea Island, and but everyone said, oh, you know, it's such a good thing, it's so charming that we live in this place that's kind of, like, really racist and old-fashioned, so, and definitely at school there was that, so, you know, this idea of, you know, people not being heterosexual wasn't mentioned, and it was only ever used as a term of abuse. So reading about frenetic gay sex in San Francisco in the 70s, and it was just thrilling and dazzling and so other. But I love the compassion of those books as well, that it's all about love stories. And I think that was possibly one of the first things I read that showed me that friendship can be a love story too.
Yeah, it's amazing how, as you say, books can take you on journeys and show you things that you didn't know were possible. And equally, take you away from people like Beth who didn't want to read it, or bring you closer to people.
It's true. Well, my friend Andy just read my book. Andy has a brilliant podcast called Backlisted, Andy Miller. He also wrote, he's written some great books, but I loved The Year of Reading Dangerously, which is like a memoir of reading. And he said, you know, he was working in publishing, I think as an editor at the time. And he just stopped reading for fun. And, you know, was sort of acquiring books, knowing about the big books, but just not read. So The Year of Reading Dangerously is this very funny, tender, sweet, and moving and kind of quietly profound book about someone rediscovering reading and rediscovering themselves as a result of it. And Andy is now a dedicated and prolific reader. I think someone on Sky Sports once Twitter bullied it because every month Andy says, here's the books I read. And they're like, well, you can't have a life or something. It was like, you know, Homer in The Simpsons going, nerd.
Really?
It's really bizarre. I am envious, I suppose, and dazzled by the breadth of Andy's reading. And he reads really great stuff and really, you know, often quite adult. Not adult, not in a rude way, but, you know.
Yeah.
I said there were books for grown-ups. So he's just read The Sisterhood. I was worried that he was never going to read it and it was going to be one of those things that he was just politely not mentioning.
Yeah.
It, like, oh, I hated this.
Yeah.
I didn't get past the second chapter. But he was very kind about it and very positive. But he also said relatability is nonsense. He may have said something less polite than nonsense, but that we shouldn't only read the books where we see ourselves. The joy of it is that we, you know, we can sometimes relate to things we never thought we would and just sometimes have our worlds blown apart by wholly different perspectives.
Definitely. And actually, I was listening to Woman's Hour, classic on Radio 4, one of my faves, I have to say. And they were saying how actually children's books can challenge a child's perception so much that they can open them up to ideas that they thought were wrong. So, for example, there was a boy who was really worried about being, like, wanting to wear women's clothes, but there's like the mermaid in the wrong outfit or something. I can't remember. I've got to look it up. And the boy that wants to be a mermaid and loves mermaids and dresses up, and it completely changed how he felt about himself. And suddenly he felt much more confident and was happy in the playground. And it's amazing that books have that power. Are there any books that have changed you, your life, and made you into the woman that you are today?
A lot. Based on, I think, what you just said, the one that really comes into my head is Matilda. And I remember being so, it felt like a book that was really, and again, to kind of contradict what I said about relatability, it felt like it was like really, it was for me when there weren't many things that were. But the idea, and this obviously comes up a lot in Roald Dahl, that adults aren't on your side. The people who are supposed to be there to look after you and to knowing and in authority, you know, they do not necessarily have your best interests at heart. And it's worth, and you, rather than being kind of alarmed and panicking, you just need to work out a way to kind of take power where you can, but to do it in a quiet way, in a smart way. We've just had the summer, and the summer in Margate is always completely busy and crazy, and all I can think about when I walk by the beach is like, there are infinity stories here. There are so many families, and it's not just like each family has a story. Each family has many stories within it, and they all contradict each other. And there's, you know, there are kids be like, that was the best day ever, and there are parents who are sort of burnt out and insane, and all of those sort of, you know, the moments of, you know, I can be walking back from doing a boring errand, like going to Morrison's, and I'll be lost in thought and thinking, damn, I forgot to get the lazy garlic and, you know, really, really boring stuff. And then someone else's world will be falling apart. People will be breaking up with each other. People will be hearing amazing, life-changing news and terrible news. And all that is going on within yards of me. It's just, it's thrilling.
It's amazing, isn't it? I've never thought about it like that. And then also like the way you tell your stories, because the thing that struck me most about your writing is how honest it is. as you spoke about earlier, I am the eldest, like you, of four children, and your book, I felt like it was telling my childhood story. And you spoke about things with in an honesty in the way that I've never even been able to vocalize them. Have you always just been able to do that, or is it something that you had to find to speak that truth? I so like it if you speak your truth, but genuinely.
No, I know what you mean. It's one of those speak your truth is a phrase that it just, you know, you hear and you go, oh God.
Yeah, exactly.
But then you're like, but yes, we should do that. Yeah. And I think that it's, we live in such an interesting time now because we pay lip service to it and we don't do it. So I had a real breakthrough. My very first writing job was at Bliss magazine, the teen mag, and I started there as an intern, and that was just brilliant in so many ways. It was like just writing boot camp, and I was so lucky to work with such brilliant people. And you know, I think that when you want to be a writer, I don't think that it is necessarily healthy or helpful to be telling your own stories from the start. I think there's a real temptation to do that, but actually I think that you need to learn to write about all kinds of other things. It can be the most boring thing in the world, but I think it's so good to have that training, because it's firstly writing for an audience and knowing the difference between what's in your head and what people might want to hear, and working out to tell a story in a certain way. It's knowing about kind of editing as well. Something that I love doing at Bliss was I edited the real life section. So I talked to teenagers who'd had, you know, some had done like very exciting things, some had overcome really big challenges, and it was my job to talk to these people and to really honour their voice and tell their story in a way that absolutely sounded like them and not me. I wasn't there, I had to disappear, but I did also have to tell it like it was telling a story, because obviously people don't necessarily have, you know, climaxes and arcs and sort of emotional highs and lows and punchlines. And that was the best possible training I could have had for this. And so that meant that when I was ready to write stuff that was much more personal, I knew it could never be gratuitous, that everything I revealed about myself had to be, you know, funny or useful, or there was no point as well telling a story that made me sound good. While I was still at Bliss, I was desperate to do a bit of more adult writing. Maybe I do mean the adult way, because I was really struggling to get other, I was applying for other jobs, and it was a sort of, oh, you know, you work in children's publishing and we're an adult magazine. It's not that kind of adult magazine. God, sorry. need to get out
the
whole
day, adult with a capital A.
But, you know, we don't think you can do it. And I felt that I think actually that would make me very good at doing it.
Yeah.
But I needed really, I suppose, more of a portfolio. So I started, I guess, blogging really for a website called Sabotage Times. And I made a decision. I read about Sabotage Times on Media Guardian. It's set up by James Brown. He did Loaded magazine. He was a real sort of, you know, publishing legend. He'd done a lot of different work. And I thought, if I have a blog, and I had a few goes at it, and it was very sort of, you know, the Wild West early days of blogs, and I couldn't quite land on what my voice was, and I thought, well, at least if my stuff is in Sabotage Times, I don't get paid, but I know people are going to read it. It's kind of a shop window. And I wrote a few things with me trying to be this kind of arch, you know, sexy single girl about town having adventures, and it wasn't good. Really wasn't good. And I could only really be funny when I was making fun of myself. And I guess back to the life-changing books, you know, it's Nora Ephron, and I love Heartburn, but I love her essays more. There's a collection, it's called Scribble Scribble. I think the subtitle is Notes on the Media, and anyone who's interested in writing and journalism, it's a textbook.
Because your writing is hilarious.
Thank you. I try.
You also succeed. And it was, I wasn't expecting it to be so funny, to the point where Jason, my husband, and I were like in fits of laughter about your arm salute in school, and like literally, and it was hilarious. And that's the bit where I text my friend Alex to say, you have got to read this book. It is absolutely amazing. But it's not like a clown book either. Your writing isn't clowny. It's like, it's hilarious, but massively truthful. It's these like belly laughs and truth bombs. And you never quite know, I never know which is coming when. It just strikes such a wonderful balance.
Well, that is such a generous compliment. Thank you so much. I mean, I think that the funniest things are the real things. I did a stand-up course at City Lit, and what I loved about it was, and it was really, really good for my writing, because I learned that you take something true and you sort of think, well, how could this be funnier? And definitely, I think something that people don't necessarily realise, and it's something that comes up when I'm talking to kind of, you know, younger writers, new writers who want advice, like, you don't have to give away as much as you think you do. And because when I write about me, I'm not just writing about me ever. You know, it's my sisters, it's my husband, it's my family, it's my friends. And in order to, I suppose, be generous and respectful and protect them a bit, you can write when I think the emotions are entirely honest and entirely truthful. And then the way you construct the story. I think in The Sisterhood, there's a bit where we've all, God, between us, you know, gone out with many, many, many terrible boys. That's
so,
you know,
many.
The 20s of the heterosexual woman. But there was a funny story about my sister Maddie's terrible ex-boyfriend. And I just shifted a few things to make it funnier. Also, there were parts of the story that were legally problematic. Ooh, okay. And I wanted to kind of avoid that whole area. And so I think I gave him a fake job. And there was something where I can't remember. He was in a road traffic accident. I sort of mended the... he was fine. I think he was fine. But it was just a sort of... I mean, that was a real clown moment. But I changed the details so much. And then when we... Because also, if you write nonfiction, you get a legal read. I imagine if you're writing... I don't know, historical books, it's probably a lot more straightforward, but they had to check.
Okay, so what does that entail? Because, I didn't know about that.
There are real people in it. So an edit where you have the sort of, you know, that's the main structure of the story and what works and what doesn't. And then it's the kind of, you know, the what. So when I gave it to my sisters to read, actually, Beth, the first thing she was doing on WhatsApp was like, oh, there's this typo in the third line and I'm not sure about that comma. Like, that's not what I wanted you to do. I don't know if you don't like the words or not. Yeah. So it goes through these, you know, to make sure that all the punctuation is in the right place or not is the next bit. And then finally, it's the legal one. So, and I think perhaps a little bit more in How to Be a Grown-Up. You know, there are friends and sort of case studies I've used and people I've interviewed. And again, it's that, just in the on the off chance that when someone tells you a story, they might be happy, but they might have mentioned someone in passing and you don't. So to make it not ambiguous exactly, but just to make sure that nobody feels, you know, slighted, or just, I think, to be, you know, as careful as you can be with other people's lives. So anyway, I changed so much about this Maddie's ex-boyfriend story, and legally, like, oh, you might want to check that and make sure those details are okay. And I'm like, I honestly can't remember what the real details are. It's like, I might act, because I made up a job for him. Like, oh, I might accidentally make up his real job to change it.
Yeah, exactly.
It gets complicated.
That is really complicated. And then, so obviously that's the sort of creative side of it. And when you had sort of what I would call being a freelancer, I was calling like real jobs and then like freelancer jobs. Freelancing is a real job, obviously, but without that kind of structure and hierarchy as much. And you have to be your own boss and advocate for yourself more. How did you find going from that environment into the freelancing environment?
It's funny how I don't know, it's almost like sort of breaking rocks, then you have a pocket where you just go wee, and then you sort of hit a hard bit again. That's a good analogy. Use your words, Daisy.
It's worked for you so far.
So I think that when I started freelancing, I left Liss and I didn't have a job to go to. And it was a kind of, you know, we have no budget. We can pay you to write one thing a month. Please leave. And I was like, shit, I don't see this working. I'm going to be living under a bridge quite soon.
Yeah.
You know, realistically moving to Dorset and living with my mum and dad, which is a lovely option, but there are no journalism jobs. I'm going to work at that call centre I've already worked at twice. Hooray. So I would say for the first 2, maybe 3 years, I just sort of worked like a hound. I was just utterly astounded that anyone would hire me for anything, and they kept doing it. And I felt so glad to be in work. And also the weird thrill was that, you know, I could what was weird actually, so at Bliss for a long time I was employed in a semi-legal way. Bliss no longer exists, so I can say this. I wasn't a staffer until the very, very end. I was always on kind of a very low day rate, and so I was like, oh god, if the Guardian asked me to write a comment piece, I can sit and do that in an hour and make more money than I would have done at a whole day. Bless my desk. This is amazing.
Yeah.
And so that whole thing, I was like, work at the weekend? Yes, please. I was just so like, and because I'd been, as I wrote quite extensively about in How to Be Grown Up, I was broke. I'd never had any money ever. I'd always been over my overdraft. I'd always been in tons of debt. It'd always been sort of chaos. And, you know, I thought, I'm just terrible with money. And I'm like, oh, I just wasn't earning any money before. And now I can earn some money. This is astonishing. So I think I burned out quite quickly, and then I kept going for well over a year after I burned out, and I never said no to anything. And I think that I hate to say it, I'm going to be honest, I think that I did quite well in my freelance career and as a writer, and I was able to establish a reputation relatively quickly because I was a workaholic without any boundaries. And it was really very bad for my mental health. And for me, the only way I could learn about that was to do it and then realize that I wasn't going to do it. And even now, and I thought, you know, I had, you know, I've had bits where, and I think I've always been aware that I've been really, really happy working for myself, much happier than I've ever been in an office. And talking to other women, I was reading something possibly by Andrea Corrado. She's got a really brilliant newsletter about freelancing, but she found some research that talked about how women seem to be freelancing a lot more than men. And the obvious answer is like, well, childcare, of course.
Yeah.
And it's not that at all.
Interesting.
It's because, and this is something that Caroline Corrado Perez writes about as well, that offices are just set up for men from kind of like the doors are the size and weight that men can push through.
Exactly.
And the temperatures are
so cold.
Wear suits.
Yeah.
I suppose I can only really talk for me, but I think lots of anecdotally, lots of friends have sort of said they can, you know, relate to this, that everything that you do in an office just seems like such sort of arbitrary nonsense. And I hate that you have to take so much time over doing something. Just it's almost, it's like, you know, showing you're working in sort of in both senses.
Yes.
And I think as well that, again, it's Matilda. You go to your job and you think everyone is senior, everyone's a grown up. Grown ups tend to have my best interests at heart. They're my, you know, my parents, my teachers, and they'll want good things for me. Not true in the office. And I think that you give a lot of your power away. One does, I certainly did, really, really quickly. And you think, oh, the harder I work and the better I do, I will be rewarded, because the world, if you're a privileged person, you more or less believe the world is a meritocracy until you're 18, until you're 21. And you're, oh, no, hold on.
No, it's
true.
Not, yeah.
And then when you're freelancing, you realize that the world just takes you at your own estimation.
Yeah.
And I think I found as well that in terms of sort of like bonuses and appraisals and perks, I'm like, oh, the only one I'm really interested in is earning more money for my work. It's great. This works very nicely for me. And I think that's it, that you realise that, and the power as well of just not having to do things you don't want to do. On Friday, I was I probably shouldn't say this, but I will. I got an email from someone saying, could you come and do this thing? And it was from a very, very well-known and slightly controversial internet brand for, I think, now popular with everybody.
Okay.
Like, we're doing a new video series. And I was, you know, I think when I first got the email, I was like, oh, I bet they've got money. Maybe I do want to find out more. And then, so I think, and it was all on LinkedIn as well. I'm like, ugh. I should really should be better at LinkedIn.
I really should get LinkedIn. I know. Sarah just looked at me in horror.
Like, yeah, everybody is wincing. Ugh. It's like everybody sort of had a cup of apple cider vinegar, like, ooh.
Yeah, exactly.
I think I accepted a LinkedIn request, and then I got an email, and there were a few more details. I was like, oh, it's going to be like a debate thing. I've done enough debates to not want to do any more. And I know that they're generally quite reductive. I don't think it's a grown-up way to argue. I don't think anything good comes of it. So I just, and it was one, the thing as well, they were asking me to debate. It's kind of, not quite this, but sort of along the lines of, so, and now to be a grown-up, you've written about, you know, it's difficult to be in your 20s. Should millennials have human rights?
Oh, and wow, great. My favourite kind of article.
I was like, I don't think this is a... Who are you going to get bring in to film to debate? No.
Yes,
no.
Who are you going to be against? And
I just said, oh, thanks for getting in touch. Not one for me. Have a good weekend. And then the reply was, oh, but we've read your articles and we think you'd be really good. Do you mind if I ask why you don't want to do this? And I'm like, firstly, my friend, yeah, I would be really good. We both know this. That's why you're getting in touch. You were not doing it to be kind. I don't know. Oh, I was just worried I'd be terrible. I feel better now. Thank you, Mr. Man. And also, I wish I could say who it was, because the irony of having to explain to this man brand that no means no is quite ironic.
It is ironic, yes.
But, so I didn't reply. And I thought that there would have been a point in my career where I would have really, really fretted about it. I'm like, oh, this is nice. I'm 34. I've said no thank you. I'm not going to enter into any further dialogue. Mm. I'm not like, oh, boo-hoo, they won't hire me. Fine.
Excellent. Yeah, and it's really interesting, isn't it, that also there's that kind of expectation that you would want to do it. Mm. And why wouldn't you? Because we're amazing. And
actually, I really need to bear that in mind more when I try to do stuff. Why wouldn't they want me to write this? Because I think I've given a talk quite recently. The talk was called Why Being Successful Won't Make You Happy, But Being Happy Might Make You More Successful. And I was exploring the idea that anything creative and exciting that we do, when we start doing it, we're flying. We've got nothing to lose. It's like we're writing bum on a wall. There's nothing interfering with our creative process, right? We're just absolutely free. And then as soon as we get any sort of success or recognition, we have something to lose, and we get absolutely so frightened about losing it. Yeah. And we feel so not seen in a good way, but looked at, that we lose our nerve. And I think that I'm really trying to remember at the moment that I'm still relatively young and new, and I want to do more and grow and get better. And so I think I've come out of a period with these two books of deep, deep anxiety. And it's not easy, but I'm just trying to be a bit more creatively free. So something I'm doing at the time of recording, September, and I'm obsessed with this woman called Brooke Castillo, who's a life coach, and she's got this podcast called The Life Coach School, and I binge it and I listen at the gym, and she's this absolute no bullshit Texan, and her philosophy is more or less, you know how you think terrible things about yourself and about what you're doing, and you worry about everything going wrong, and that makes you terribly unhappy. Have you thought of not doing that? Have you thought about thinking of nice things? And Even maybe this time last year, we're like, ha, 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 what are you, stupid?
Yeah.
That's not going to work. And I'm like, actually, it has started to work for me. So one of her central ideas is life is supposed to be a bit crap 50% of the time. because that's how much you're meant to be challenging yourself. That's you're supposed to be in awkward situations. If you've not got that 50-50 ratio of sort of, you know, happy and sad slash annoying slash inconvenient, it means that you're probably not pushing yourself hard enough. And that was quite a sort of revelatory thing.
Yes,
you,
that's interesting. Yeah.
And you hear it and you're like, but I want nice things to be nice.
All the time.
And then sort of, I really, really resisted it at first. And also like, oh, there's not going to be a point that I reach where it is nice all the time. That's not what success is. I'm trying to do in September a dare of the day. Now, what makes me, what's
excellent,
quite
okay,
eye-opening, my dare of the day is like, yeah, mostly that's sending an email I don't really want to send. And you're like, I should never complain about anything ever when the hardest thing I have to do is emails. But
I mean, don't get me started on email anxiety.
For example, on Sunday, I saw, I probably can't say them yet because it's all very, very early in the email stage, but a sort of a brand who's doing a fun, cool, creative thing. And I thought, oh, they'd be fun to collaborate with. And I see they're doing this work with this person. They've not asked me. And mm-hmm. I'm like, dare of the day. Gonna slide into their DMs.
Excellent.
Say, hello, I like what you do. Do you want to do something? And they seem keen on doing something. It's all a bit early yet. But I've definitely had periods of my life where I've panicked and thought, oh God, they're doing so much. And I'm not, you know, looked at people. I've really, really struggled and suffered with jealousy and envy, which I think is quite universal.
Definitely, especially in our age of social media, where
yes.
comparison enters your life at every single point that you engage in Instagram.
I've got a theory that we all talk about how social media is terrible because we never talk to each other and it's all just screens. It's not just that. I think it means that such is the proliferation of it, that when we do get together with our friends, we talk to each other in like a Facebook way or an Instagram way, and we don't have lovely chats and like, oh, did you see this exhibition and I thought this and what do you think? Or I saw this funny thing. Or it's not like a conversational jam. It's more, hi, I have an announcement.
Yes.
We're getting an extension. I've had a promotion. What are your announcements? And we just sort of fire these like weird bullet lists about it. You know, I love my friends and I'm always glad to hear their news, but I don't really give a shit about anyone's extension. Yeah.
Well, however exciting it is for them.
Unless you're going to, you know, put a dining table in and have me round and
exactly.
eat delicious food,
that
I'm
we can
all
get on board
in,
with.
But...
And just to go back to your dare of the day and emails. So for someone that wants to approach an opportunity or they're in having a freelance career and they want to approach someone, how should that email look?
I mean, I think that with any commissioning editors, the thing that I really, really had to remind myself of is people in that world, they're, you know, they have money. They want writers. They are generally excited to hear from new writers. They might not get back to you for the first few tries because everyone is emailing all day long and their inbox is a bit of a bin fire. But whatever they think when they see your email, they will not think, how dare they?
Yes,
I think this is the worst email I've ever been sent. And I think that is always what was putting me off.
That is so interesting because that is, when I think about, when you say that, I'm like, yes, that is exactly what I think when I send an email like that. But it's true. And I would never think that of someone emailing me. It's so refreshing to hear a woman talking about making money and actively wanting to make money. It's not something that we discuss massively.
Well, this is what Brooke Castillo is so great on. She has really, really shifted my mindset. She talks very openly about being a life coach, wanting to make $100 million, which seems insane.
Your target.
And you see, the first, you know, when I heard that, I was like, it seems a bit vulgar to want $100 million. I should just be happy with my lot and make do. And I think that so much. So I also have been doing more speaking around finances and mental health because I'm just so sick of like, oh, you don't have any money because of the coffee and the avocados.
Oh, don't
calm
get started on the avocados.
And for all of us, but especially with women, there's a sense that we can only be good with money by depriving ourselves. And there is no one saying, but make money. And also that, oh, well, women just, you know, they don't ask for raises and that's why they don't make it. Like, we do. Of course
yes.
we do. And this is why I think that office culture doesn't serve us. someone who's brilliant and amazing and so talented, who I really respect and admire. She went freelance because she was like, I've been doing a lot for a long time. I think she was acting up for someone who left, and then she got their job and just professionally killing it. She said, you really need to give me more money. No. And so she went, fuck this. I'm off. I'm leaving. And then they said, oh no, you can have that money actually.
Oh, interesting.
But then it was too late. And now she is consulting. She's writing. She's doing all kinds of very cool and thrilling things. And I think that so much of it with money is it's very, very hot. And I don't always do this. It's really, really difficult to shift the idea that someone else tells you what you're worth, and that's it.
Interesting.
And
yes,
it's so arbitrary. And the advice I love the most, that I find the most useful, is it's that this is the 50% of the time when you're tolerating discomfort. This is everything about, I think this applies to so many different people, but for women especially, we are told to make life easy and comfortable for everyone. So you say a number and there's a silence, you will feel obliged to say, oh no, but of course I just really want to do it and I could do it for this much. You just, you know, hold your tongue, ride out the uncomfortableness. I remember doubling a rate. I was offered some work and it was for a brand, and I was like, oh sure, I bet they have money, definitely do that. And then they said the number, and I'm like, whoa, who do they think is going to do this with that much money? Not me. So I emailed and said, I'm sorry, the lowest I could do it for is twice that. But I'm happy to recommend some like less experienced writers who, you know, might be able to do it. And they're like, oh no, we can give you double. And purely because I didn't, you know, I knew the work was kind of going to be boring and annoying, and I didn't really want to do it. And it's one of those things where I thought, well, that, you know, all together, it's a chunk of money to have, but the hours that will go in and the back and forth, like, no, thank you. And just, you know, and I wasn't feeling uncomfortable at all. It was just because it came in, I was thinking, I guess this isn't for me. Right then, sorry, no, it would cost you this much if I did it, and there's no way you're going to double it.
And they did. I mean, so it is always worth asking. Mm. And I think it is also worth saying that even if you do pluck up the courage to ask, quite often, unfortunately, well, no, not maybe not quite often, but sometimes people will make you feel guilty, and they will make you feel like you're, and I have had this experience, like naughty for asking. And that shouldn't mean that you don't ask the next time.
It's absolutely true. And I think that people don't consciously do that. They're not being like, oh, I will keep this woman down by making her feel terrible. And I think if you're asking for a raise and it's your full-time job and it's where you spend a big percentage of your waking hours, not getting a pay rise that you ask for, it's like being told off by a parent sometimes. Or, you know, you feel it's such a bigger sort of proportion of your life that I think there's a real culture of sort of shame and anxiety. But if you're, you know, if the offer comes in and they're like, oh, could you do this for this much? And you say, no, I'll do it for that much. And they say no, then like, oh no, you've just lost the opportunity for them to come back to you and undercut you again.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Honestly, I was offered some shifting work on a newspaper, and it was Saturday nights, rubbish money, not doing any writing. And also the big thing was, I think it would have ended after midnight, and this is pre-night tube, and I'm like, I don't really know how I get home safely at that point. So I had this sort of, you know, talked on the phone to this guy a few times, and he's really quite intense, and I was just, every time I thought about it, the more I just felt like, there's no part of this that I want to do. And then, you know, I said, I've been thinking about it and I'm sorry and I really don't think this is for me. And then it was, oh God, honestly, it reminded me of, you know, sometimes, I say this is someone who is, you know, lived as a straight cis lady, when you're having a nice chat with a guy and you're like, oh, maybe, maybe. And then you think, oh, actually, no. And then... and there's a possibility that something's going to happen, and then you're like, decided against it. And then you try to kind of extricate yourself, and he turns. And you see the darkness in his eyes, and there's a real like, I have been thwarted. I'm not all the charm, everything that is making you think about doing it is switched off. And this is exactly how it was with that guy on the phone. And I remember feeling a bit bullied, and that he was, you know, kind of like, well, you know, you're making a big mistake. And, you know, if you wanted to get on at this particular newspaper, who I'd been freelancing for quite a while and writing a regular column for, be like, oh, you know, well, this isn't going to help your career at all. And I remember thinking, phew, imagine working for that guy. Absolutely. I've had a lucky escape. It took me a long, long, long time to pluck up the courage to say no. But saying no really means that, you know, bigger and better stuff comes down the pipeline. And I think that's something that I'm struggling with now, because I have always been, I think, a journalist, and now journalism is looking very different. Freelancing is looking very different. I'm, you know, I have a relatively new podcast. It's just started its fourth series. I think it's a very, very, very hard time to be starting in journalism now. But, you know, maybe sometimes my dare of the day is going to be saying no, because I'm still really frightened that I'll say no and I'll never be asked back, that, you know, this will be the career end of that person who was like, well, if you don't do this, then you should think seriously about your future here at the school/newspaper. You know, maybe it will be kind of career ending, but maybe I just, you know, care less. And maybe I need to remind myself sometimes that progress isn't linear. And that also I get to say how successful I am. This is very new to me.
Absolutely, yeah.
This is very, the idea of admitting to it, it makes me want to die a little bit. But something that is also new is coming back to authenticity. And I think that a struggle for me with writing very personally has been that for a while I've thought that authenticity needs to be maybe making people feel good about themselves. Like, oh, you thought you're crap. Well, I'm a crapper, and look at this terrible thing. And
yeah.
Really, you know, here is my shame. Here are my failures. Here are where I feel bad about myself. Something I'm, I suppose, flirting with is that authenticity might be quietly acknowledging the good stuff too, and not feeling as though I have to kind of dissemble a failure. That it's perhaps not always my job to make people feel better. And to go back to Brooke, who I love, she says that she wants to be an example of what is possible. And I love that idea.
Yeah, and what I'd say, Daisy, is like, thank you so much for sharing, and thank you for writing your books. Like, How to Be a Grown-Up has changed, and The Sisterhood, they've both changed how I operate in my life. And I think your voice changes women's lives, and we need more women like you to do that. And it's brilliant. So please carry on. And thank you so much for coming today.
Love, I had to break eye contact then. I might cry.
No!
It's a lot. Can we sing a song or something?
Definitely. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. Daisy was absolutely hilarious and, as I'm sure you'll agree, full of really good advice. If you want to read either of her books, How to Be a Grown Up and The Sisterhood, I would definitely recommend those. And her podcast, You're Booked, is fantastic as well. All of that is linked in the show notes below. And next week, I'll be talking to the Atlantic Antics ladies. They are the Osh Huns who are going to be rowing the Atlantic Ocean. They are aiming to be the fastest and youngest female trio to row unaided across the Atlantic Ocean. It is an epic feat. Join me next week and we'll hear how they're preparing and how they're using their voices for change. And of course, don't forget to rate, review and subscribe, as it really helps other people find us. See you next week.